Hello, everybody, and welcome to the QU Media Podcast Network. I'm your host, Michael Wheeler, along with Maddie Norris, Evan White, Chloe Knott, Eric Stafford, and Sierra Miller. Okay, thank you, Sierra. Today we have a closing conversation. I believe that this is our last podcast of the semester. Woo, excited, everybody. We have, I believe everybody here is writing a 20-page paper.
Yeah, we're all doing our final research paper for our communication major.
Okay, so starting off, I just wanted to ask everybody what that writing process was like. Because 20 pages, that's vicious. I'm not going to lie. It's real vicious. So starting with...
So 20 pages is...
That's gone.
That's long gone. My research paper ended up being, I think it was 36 pages, 37 pages.
But why did it go overboard? Like, was it because you just had, like, so much to, dissect?
Well, okay, so she told us pretty much that somewhere around the 25 to 30 range was the sweet spot, okay. Pretty much. She said she didn't have a limit on pages. She didn't have a guide, really, for how many pages, as long as we got all of our information out and written and all of that, everything we were supposed to have. But my topic was extremely large, and so that is why I'm
talking about your topic for a little bit. Talk about your topic.
Okay, so my topic was sexual assault communication. So really the basis of it was the fact that society fails sexual assault victims so often, and now it's, you know, gotten up into the higher teachings of counseling and how police officers talk with sexual assault survivors. So it's really how we can be better equipped to interact when a disclosure is placed in front of us. So I really did research to find the Innocence First Responders Toolkit to help a sexual assault survivor with telling their story if you're approached with it.
So break down some of the things that were provided in that toolkit, if you can remember.
Yeah, of course. So I ended up sending out a survey. I posted it on Facebook, actually, so I didn't limit the sources in which it came. So I didn't want just college students. I didn't want just female. I sent it out on Facebook. And I got a fantastic response and had 65 individuals fill out my survey.
That's pretty broad.
Yes. The age range was 16 to 70. And there were both male and female. The majority were female by a large sum. It was like 82% were female that filled out my survey. And then after the survey was completed, individuals had an area at the bottom of the survey where they could either reach out to me or they would leave their email and I could reach out to them. So that was their way of letting me know that they were willing to talk to me and their information could be used. So I ended up interviewing 25, around 25 individuals separately.
Now, were these face-to-face interviews or, like, through the phone?
So, email? I mean, honestly, it was, like, split down the middle of, right. Like, half of them got to be in person, half of them were over the phone, and then I think, like, two or three were over email.
Okay.
So I got a really, really great response. And then on the other side of things, I also ended up interviewing counselors, violence prevention specialists, police officers, security, all everyone that I could when it came to someone that's supposed to be a trained professional in working with sexual assault survivors. And I got kind of their take on how they interact with survivors along with their background and their training that they had to go through to be able to be equipped, I guess you could say, to work with survivors. But then, in conclusion, I pretty much got what survivors needed rather than what each profession needed. So that kind of became the conclusion of my project. We as humans are very selfish, and we want to have all of the information that would benefit us. And we try and get to the bottom of things as a society. So if someone, for example, say someone comes to us about their disclosure, we're constantly trying to figure out the full story because we think that's our place, is to know the full story. We want to know the tea. But
I mean, as reporters, that's our job. We got to get every angle from the story of the story and try to, sorry for cutting you off, first of all. But yeah, just try to cover the story as best as possible without, what is it, minimizing harm? Isn't that one of the code of ethics or something like that? So yeah, just trying to get that story out without damaging the person's reputation, ego, pride, all that, just face in general. So it's a real, especially when talking about a situation like this or a topic like this, it's real. You kind of got to walk on eggshells.
Unfortunately, historically speaking, police get the bad rep. Us as media, it is not our job to know what they were wearing and stuff like that. But unfortunately for police officers, that is their job. So I have talked to several people about that side of things just because it is a very hard process for a victim to approach a police officer just because the extensive amount of re-traumatization that happens when reaching out to a police officer, by no fault of the police officer, is just really hard for a victim because they have to completely relive the situation. They have to tell their story 30 different times. They have to answer every victim-blaming question that, once again, can't be thrown back on the police officer because they're just trying to collect evidence. But we as a society think it's our job to also ask those questions when it's not. We do not need to ask the victim-blaming questions, and it's our job to believe the victim rather than send the victim away, because that's why so many stories go unheard. And Eric and I were actually having a conversation the other day in Barb's class about my research topic, and he was talking about one of the recent famous, who was it?
NFL player Deshaun Watson.
Yeah, I mean, there's several NFL or NBA or larger name athletes that have been called out for things of this nature. And I would like to point out that only 2 to 10% of sexual assault disclosures are actually false allegations. So we like to think that all of these false allegations are thrown out there and there's a million false allegations out there, but really it's only 2 to 10%. So the rest of the time, every single story is correct. Every single story is a sexual assault story. So that's why we so often as a society completely fail survivors. And that's why the hashtag MeToo movement took so long. I mean, Larry Nassar was sexually assaulting these young women for decades. Larry Nassar was the USA women's gymnastics doctor who sexually assaulted over like 200 young females. So yeah, he is now behind bars, but it took a very long time to get there. So in conclusion, it's not our job to ask the victim blaming questions. It's not our job to ask questions at all, really. It's our job to give back the power and the control and the voice that was taken away from the survivor. It's our job to give that back to them. So it's our job to listen to them, to believe them, and not to push them or hide their story. So that's really what the conclusion came to. And I mean, even just looking at my survey response, I mean, I had 65 people fill out my survey, most of them being anonymous. I'd say probably 85% of them like wanted to remain anonymous. So that tells me right there that, you know, all of these sexual assault victims still want to remain anonymous, but they want their story heard. They want their voice to be heard. So just imagine if we could start helping and benefiting these sexual assault survivors, how many stories would come out. Real
talk. I feel like a conversation like that definitely needs to be had, and further research, as you're doing, needs to be conducted as well. But moving on to our next guest that we have, for lack of a better term, Evan White, what's your story about, man?
So mine's is over communication apprehension, and that's just when an individual is not necessarily afraid, but more so like trying to avoid speaking to another individual or in like large groups. It can just come from like having a certain level of like uncertainty. So like, for example, I could be talking to you, Micah, because I know that we're close about a certain topic, but like, say, like, if I was to be put on like a podium or a stand and someone asked me, how do I feel about this? That would be more so like what my topic is about. So just being afraid to just talk in like larger groups.
Okay, so what do you feel like that afraidness, for lack of a better term, I don't know how to, whatever, but what do you feel like that fear comes from? Like, what do you think that stems from? Is that, what is it, anxiety?
You hit it right on the nose. I would say anxiety, just because someone could be just have anxiety just by talking to someone who's unfamiliar to them. Like, right. If you don't know the person, if you never seen the person. And believe it or not, a lot of times, like, when people go into, like, counseling and stuff like that, they are speaking to a counselor that they never seen before, that mm-hmm. they don't know nothing about. And it's kind of weird because... I know people personally that would rather go to a counselor that they never seen or don't know about than going to a family member or a closer friend, just because they're in that field, so they feel more comfortable,
right?
Like that. But yeah, I would definitely say just coming from like anxiety. I
mean, but you could kind of see that in two, like it's kind of a double-edged sword, because if you talk to somebody that you've never met before, like some people would view that as like. You can never understand what I'm going through, like right. No matter what degree that you have, no matter any of that. But then if you talk to someone who isn't a counselor, who had actually been through the path that you have been through, you know what I'm saying? You'll feel more confident in talking to them because they actually could see eye to eye with you.
Yes, that's true.
So, yeah, just continue. I'm sorry for cutting you.
Oh, no, you're good. And I just want to add this. Another reason why I know why some people could be like have anxiety with talking, just because they could be like afraid of someone may judge them, you know, like speaking in public. Like, let's say like I'm talking amongst like 30 people. What I would tell you, I probably wouldn't say, like, say like if it's like a personal issue that I'm dealing with in my life and I'm at an event or something like that, I could probably talk to you all day about one particular problem. But like, in a large crowd, I may be beating around the bush, or I may not answer what someone may be looking for. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
And I don't know how that would affect me as a person, because like what someone may say or what someone may think, is it all plays a part. But yeah, the root of it is would be like anxiety. And another word for my topic, communication apprehension, would be just like communication uncertainty. So just like avoiding, you know, just speaking in groups. Like that.
That makes sense. So what do you feel like a person can do to overcome those fears?
I would definitely say it takes time. It's not nothing that you can overcome overnight. Mm-hmm. I would recommend just by like speaking in like smaller groups, or just like talking to someone that you're closer with. And depending on like what area you are in life, that can determine like how you will begin speaking. So like I would say just like speaking in like smaller groups, or even like, what do they call those? Like, you could probably help me out. Like the circles. I can't think of it. Anyway.
Yeah. I don't know.
Just like, you know how people got like, for example, like I think they call like a sister group or something like that. Like if you're in an organization or something like that,
right.
I feel like that would be much better for someone who is not familiar with speaking like
strangers. To be
real,
piggybacking
like
off of that, because like at the end of the football season, all the seniors would have to go up in front of the team and like basically tell them, like, oh, I love y'all, I'm gonna miss y'all, all this and that, the third. But, like, when I had to do it in my last season, when I had to do it, it really wasn't anything nerve-wracking because, one, it's 100. We had 120 people on the team. All of those faces I'm familiar with. But if we took those same 120 people and put them with unfamiliar faces, I would have been sweating. I would have been voice shaky, you know. But, like, it's so, like you said, it's, like, more of a comfort thing. And, like, I feel I agree with what you said. Starting that smaller group of people that you're familiar with and then just branch out. Just trial by fire, for real. Trial by fire.
And I just want to add this. To piggyback off Maddie's story, I really like your topic with the sexual assault. Like, for example, like, even when it comes to stuff like that, like, a lot of times when people come out, they can be, like, condemned, or people could say they're lying, mm-hmm. or this never happened, or even if it's, like, a case that involves, like, a celebrity or a professional player or something like that, people be like, I know him outside of the sport. He would never do nothing like that. I never heard him talk like that and stuff like that. But it takes a brave person to even, like, come out and say anything to anyone, you know, and maybe they not ready to speak in front of, like, 30 people, or they may not want to be interviewed or recorded. And that's the main reason why a lot of people can remain anonymous, mm-hmm. just because they know that someone could be coming after them. So just, like, to piggyback off of hers, that could be another reason why a lot
that's
of people
crazy.
Could have
you
anxiety.
Hand to hand like that. That's real crazy. But that's cool. All right, moving on to our next guest, we have Chloe Knott. What is your story about, Chloe?
All right. My research was quite different, I guess, but it was on the importance of shared spaces on college campuses where people can, like, hang out, eat, particularly in eating, sharing meals with other people, and how that influences people's behavior and mood, what they eat when they're around different people. And yeah, that was kind of what I researched. And I really just focused on QU students. I did a survey and just got a lot of interesting feedback on like why people thought it was important to, like, eat a meal with other people rather than by themselves, and what they feel could make a change within, like, QU particularly, like, what could be better to, like, support that environment of to make everything feel a bit more community, socially beneficial to their time at college. And it was, I think I kind of got interested in the topic after, like, COVID and everything kind of shutting down. We couldn't, like, go out and eat with friends. You couldn't go to the cafe and, you know, have a meal with everyone. Everything changed. And just how that is influential into like our entire life, because we all eat, you know, we have to do that every day. Just how interesting that is, not just eating, but how social that has become in all our lives.
I think, too, something we talked about in class that obviously no one else but our class got to hear that I think was really interesting is you also focused and asked how people, like, grew up. Right. So then that really got to, like, make me think. And I was like, you know, my family had the rule. If we were home as a family, we were eating dinner at the table as a family. And, like, we made that a rule. And so, I mean, I was a very busy child, and I wasn't home every night because of sports and this and that. But I remember eating dinner 3-4 times a week, sitting down at the table, no phones at the table, no nothing. We had to, you know, go around the table, talk about our day, ask each other questions. Like, we had to be present with each other. And then when I would have friends over and we would sit down, add them a plate at the table, sit down as a family and just, like, hang out, my friends would be like, oh, you don't just, like, get your food and go to your room.
And I thought that was absolutely bizarre growing up. Because, I mean, but to them, it was bizarre for me to sit down and eat family dinner every night. They were like, oh, no, like, I couldn't do that. I'm like, well, I couldn't do what you do. That's so lonely. Yeah, that's, like, I don't understand. Terrible.
Like, these people you live with and you don't even spend time and get to congregate with them, like, that doesn't even make sense.
Yeah,
like,
for
these
sure.
are your blood, your flesh and blood, and you just want to be by yourself when you're with your family? Like, come on. That don't make no sense. But going back to Chloe, what do you feel like the importance is of being able to sit with a group of people that you enjoy their company? Like, what do you think that importance brings to oneself?
I think, especially at college, it's like a new experience when you are away from your family that you've had, like, for people like Maddie, or like myself, who have had that community just within your family growing up at that mealtime, to then not have that, I think, can be a very lonely, distant part of your life if you don't have that anymore. And to be able to go to a place where you can meet people, where you can be with friends, be with classmates, teammates, I think it's a important bonding experience that we really don't get to have otherwise. I mean, you don't get to share those, like, casual moments with, you know, in class or while you're at practice or something, being able to sit down and just kind of talk. I think a lot of different conversations come out, and I think a lot of the responses in my surveys was that it's just, like, a very unique kind of time where you get to share the, like, share an experience with other people and have that bonding opportunity.
Real talk. I mean, but some people, like, I understand you want to eat alone. Because, like, I like sometimes, I mean, I ain't going to say all the time, but, yeah, like, some days I just want to be by myself, enjoy my food, and just go on about my day, you know what I'm saying? But, like, the people that you see in the cab every day sitting by themselves, not kicking it with nobody, not just eating by themselves. Like, do you feel like those people are just waiting for somebody to kind of bring them in and, like be like, hey, come be a part of us? Right. Or would that stem from,
I think it can
social anxiety type,
yeah,
thing?
I think often people, if they don't have that community, obviously they might be looking for community. They might be looking for someone to be like, hey, can I come sit with you? Or, you know, do something like that. But even just having that shared space of, like, the cafeteria, even if you do sit alone, I think it's just being around other people can be uplifting compared to, you know, taking that food back to your room and sitting alone. Just having those opportunities for spaces to socialize, and it's kind of a bit more of a free, open environment to, like, go and sit with someone you don't know, or for, yeah, just have that moment where it's available to meet other people.
Yeah, right. I feel like the Cav is like an everyday campus event. Like, you go to the Cav, you see people outside of actual events that happen on campus, because that's usually, excuse me, that's usually the time where you get to see, like, the most people in one space. Like, if there's, like, an event like the Balloon Glow, that was probably the most people in Quincy that I ever seen. But, yeah, like, just going to the Cav, like you said, just seeing people sitting around, it's uplifting, because judging off of where we came from, COVID 2020,
right,
there wasn't nobody around anybody. Mm-hmm. And that was really depressing. I ain't gonna lie. That was really depressing.
Yeah.
But, yeah, that's a good topic. I appreciate that. Moving on to Eric Stafford. Eric, what you got for us today, man?
Yes, so for my senior seminar project, I'm doing the communication between athletes and non-athletes, like how athletes communicate to non-athletes is, I feel like, a big difference in some ways. You feel me? Like, I feel like athletes, especially, like, certain sports like basketball, I would say football, almost every sport, volleyball, lacrosse, it's a lot of big communication. Like, I went to a lacrosse game the other day, about, like, 2 weeks ago, and I didn't know how much you have to really pay attention and really be, like, locked in, be ready to go out there and like ready for your coach to sub you in and stuff. Like, it's crazy. Like, you really have to be in tune. You have to be locked in. Like, communication is crazy. Like, some people wouldn't be ready for that. Like, even me playing basketball, like, I'll be lost out there trying to sub in for like lacrosse and stuff. Like, with basketball, it's kind of easier to sub. Like, with that crap, you got to be ready to run out there. You got to be on go. If I would say for like non-athletes, just regular students, not everybody, but I would feel like some people that never played sports, they're probably more quiet and ducked off. They don't feel as comfortable talking or, you know, like certain stuff, like to speak up and stuff like that. Like, I feel like in a lot of situations, I'm not really scared to like say my opinion or speak up, like not in a controversial way where I'm trying to go against you, but if it's something that needs to be said, I'm not as hesitant, you know. Somebody that doesn't play a sport, they might shy away from it, or, you know, they might not say anything at all. They might just let it be. Like, little stuff like that, especially, like, leadership roles and managing roles is just a big difference.
But do you feel like, excuse me, do you feel like sports shaped you into that person that's not afraid to speak out about a certain situation?
Or yeah, I would say majorly, especially, like, being a guard, I feel like we always had to be more verbal, and I feel like, especially like my role, like certain people, like it's a lot of good players. Some people aren't as vocal, like ball players, but I feel like for me to get on the floor or just be involved, you know what I mean, to get minutes, I had to be like a vocal energy guy, you know what I mean, where I had to be loud, you feel me? Certain stuff like that, had to have a motor, you know. Some people don't have a motor at all.
I dig that. And I feel like competition really brings out the drive, like the hunger to be better than the person that you're going against. And so I feel like that competition, that drive, that hunger breeds that inner, what is it? What's the word I'm looking for? I got this on the tip of my tongue. It breeds that inner, what's the word? It's like self-confidence.
Mm-hmm.
It breeds that inner self-confidence when you're in the heat of competition and you know, like, because I'm sure you play guard, bro. You play guard. When you mix somebody, bro, like, you like, he can't mess with me for the rest of the game.
Yeah, and I feel like that transitions over, like, real-life situations, too, because, like,
real talk.
I feel like sometimes, you know, this is probably a bad thing. This is an ego thing probably, too, because sometimes back in my head, I feel like I'm Michael Jordan or something.
Like, in real life. Like, not even on the court. Like, in real life.
You feel me? Because I don't know. I just feel like
I'm. But that's okay, though. Yeah, that's cool.
You feel me? As long as you, like, stay humble with it. Because I don't know. I just feel like I know who I am. You know, I never had to really fake it or whatever.
Right.
So, like, you know, it's a different type of compatible, like, comfort level I feel like I'm at. You feel me? With just being me.
That's real talk. So, I like Evan said, people that deal with social anxiety, I suggest you get into a sport, real talk, because it'll clear out your system. Because once you enter into that sport and you realize that this is something, first, you got to realize that this is something that you want to do.
Yeah.
But two, once you realize that this is something that you want to exceed in, bro.
And I would say, too, like, being uncomfortable makes you comfortable because, like, I feel like sports puts you at that a lot. Like, just being cursed out, called out your name or something like that by a coach. Like, I feel like it prepares you a little bit better for life and how to deal with stuff because, like, you know, like, I feel like now I'm at the age where, like, can't nobody really say nothing to me where it's, like,
that'll
knock me off. Mm-hmm. Like, okay, it is what it is. You feel me? Like, we're going to keep it pushing. Like, certain people, like, I feel like for non-athletes, they never played sports or whatever, so they might get told something that this makes them, like, I got family members and friends that never played sports, and you can say something to them and just knock out their whole mood. Like, they'll be mad for, like, the whole day, throw temper tantrums. Right. Like, these are grown people, you feel me? Like, just, they can't function, you feel me? Mm-hmm. It's just weird.
It's a different environment. It's definitely a different environment, but that's a real good topic. Moving on to Sierra. Sierra, what you got for us today?
Yeah, so I did my research paper on motorsports media and focused on the uses and gratifications theory by Katz and Blummer. So just kind of understanding how and why people use the media to satisfy their needs and, like, the history of it. So, like, when did the broadcasts come into play? When did social media take off? And so for my research, I just really kind of monitored social media, saw what people were talking about, what do they kind of consume on social media, why do they consume it? And then I used an existing survey. I didn't send one out. I found one that got over 55,000 responses, and I knew I wasn't going to get that.
55K.
Yeah, a lot. So I asked Barb, hey, can I use this? And she was like, yeah, absolutely. So from that, I was able to see just kind of like the age groups, and it was a global survey too. So I found out that the majority of people use TV and broadcast to consume the racing content, but people like our age use more of social media. So just kind of dived into that and the history of the media, and kind of looked into why the team, or how and why the teams and drivers and industry members use it too, how they kind of leverage that for their sponsors, and just kind of what goes on in podcasts and social media and broadcasts.
Okay, so I'm not really too familiar with the racing industry, so break down what it is about the media that can kind of help a racer get to that next level.
Yeah, so I think the business model for racing is different than a lot of other sports. You have to have a sponsor to go racing just because it's so expensive. So social media and the media as a whole is used as a tool by drivers and teams to kind of pull sponsorship in. If you have more of a following in the media, you're going to be able to use that to bring on more sponsorship, which is going to help you to go racing. So it's pretty big, and so that's why kind of the media is really important.
So how would a racer like kind of put themselves out there to sponsor, to be like, hey, sponsor, like, are you in your car driving 180? What is it?
Yeah, so I think having like a good social media team, or like good photos is huge for like your graphics, and having good graphic design, having good videos and sound and stuff to put out, and putting stuff out regularly. And then also the PR side is huge, because if your sponsors aren't happy, if you do something wrong, they're not going to want to sponsor you if you're putting out stuff that's, you know, inappropriate on social media.
Right.
It's a pretty big part of it all.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
So it's really, like how every other sponsorship is. Like if you disown us in any way, if you do anything that kind of messes with the brand, like, we'll just drop you.
But at the same time, it's also important to kind of have your own personal brand. Mm-hmm. So I think that it's, you have to find a balance in it all. So it's been really interesting to research.
I dig that. Mm-hmm. So, and then you talked about like the social media and like the media. So what is, and you talked about how people consume media. So just when you open up, let's say, pick a random platform, Twitter.
Yeah.
What's the one thing, and you go to trending, what's the one thing that you see? Because for me, I see the Johnny Depp. I see everything that's going on with Johnny Depp. That's trending right now.
Yep.
But like, how people consume that versus, because that just might be me. That just might be what's popping up on my newsfeed. I don't know what's popping up on everybody else's newsfeed.
Yeah.
But like, how can you kind of measure
like the racing side of things versus the current events?
Right.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting side. And I think if I had more time to do research, I'd probably dive into that. But I don't know. That's a great question.
That's crazy.
I think that sometimes.
I'm thinking too broad.
You're good. I think that sometimes if you have, though, like a crazy sort of event or something that happens, it will kind of go on your general trending page too. So sometimes stuff like that can kind of match up.
So like, God forbid, if top-notch racer passes away.
Yeah.
Like, that'll be boom.
Yeah.
First thing that, okay.
Or, like, an accident or some kind of controversy. Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, that does reach more of the main side of media, I guess. Right. But, yeah.
That's crazy. Well, that is all the guests that we have for today. This is our last show, correct?
This is, yeah.
Yeah.
This is it.
Dang, where the applause at? Let me see. let me make sure I get it. We finished up. We thank y'all for being here with us on the QU Media podcast. You can check us out at qumedia.net, and you can check out our stories on wordpress.com, and also tune in to the QU TV news. What channel is that on? On the Comcast, whatever.
1809. 1901. 1901. And social media as well.
Yes, sir. You'll go check that out. And thank you for joining us. This is Michael Wheeler along with the guest, and